From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made with a set of polls taken in late June, presidential polls. The debate, between President Biden and former President Trump had just happened. Democrats were, as the cliche now goes, in genuine disarray. For months, a small but growing number of Democratic influencers has been calling for Joe Biden to leave the race. Chief among the critics was Ezra Klein of the New York Times. But when the polls came out, a number of Democrats argued that the data was clear. It was too risky to ask Biden to leave the race. Sure, he was way behind in the seven battleground states that would decide the election. He had lost ground with just about every demographic group, especially younger voters and black men. But Biden was a known commodity. Any other Democrat would not have enough time. The polling at that time showed two interesting things about Vice President Kamala Harris. When matched up with Trump, she fared essentially the same as Biden, if not a point or two better. She was still well behind. But in terms of favorability numbers, her ratings were very low. She was no sure bet to win in a matchup with Trump. How about other Democrats who could run? Here's where it gets really interesting. The polling showed that a generic younger Democrat, a nameless younger Dem, would flip all seven battleground states and beat Trump. But when you put in the specific names, Pete Buttigieg, Gretchen Whitmer, Wes Moore, Gavin Newsom, Josh Shapiro, they often polled worse than Biden. How is that possible? Well, Ezra Klein argued it was simple. The public didn't know the other possible contenders yet. But if a new ticket was chosen, Klein argued that those names would become household names within a week, and then the polling would move. Well, look at what has happened with Minnesota Governor Tim Walz. A week ago, how many Americans knew who he was? How many know him today? How many will know him next week? That doesn't mean the polling is definitive. It is August. National polls now show essentially a tied race within the margin of error. Battleground states have moved in Vice President Harris's direction. They look razor thin, but the leads that Donald Trump had a couple of months ago appear to be gone. Again, it's still August. Can we assume that the polling movement will continue in the Democrats' direction? The Democrats hold their convention later this month. Should they get a bump out of that event? And what about groups within the left, groups that are still uncommitted? We saw Vice President Harris shut down protesters at a campaign stop in Michigan this week. Those protesters want a ceasefire in Gaza, for starters. Harris says she's willing to continue that conversation, but she did not appreciate the protesters trying to repeatedly interrupt her campaign event. Could her approach help or hurt her? Joseph Burgess is a regular guest on this program, and he is someone who helps us understand data, understand polling in context. He's a team leader at the Social Sciences Data Lab at the University of Copenhagen and joins us now. I hope that is still your title. It's been a little while. How are you, Joseph Burgess?
It has. Thank you so much for having me on Connections yet again, Evan. I'm delighted to be here. You know, it's funny. We've been talking about doing an episode for a long time. And every time we thought about it, things just seem to keep happening.
Yes, a lot of change. So let me start with this here. It is August. We are, just under 3 months to the American general election here. How valuable are the current polls that we're seeing? And by valuable, I mean, you know, people start to get worked up a lot in the fall. Well, it's late summer now. Is there value to the polls that we're seeing?
I'm going to give you a half answer to that. So let's pretend it's a normal election cycle, and we haven't had one of those in a while, but let's pretend it is. Mm-hmm. People generally say that after the two conventions, presidential nominating conventions, and after Labor Day, that's when you could expect the polls to be kind of at their highest validity until the actual election day. So we're getting pretty close to Labor Day, obviously, so we're approaching that point. That being said, we've had a number of very massive events recently, which is what we were just referring to. We can just list them off, but I think most listeners will know most of them. So I think those are really could still be sinking in for voters, especially voters who are not necessarily really tuned into kind of the day to day of the presidential race. So the various events are kind of still sinking in. And I think it'll take some time maybe for polling to potentially settle down as voters continue to both learn more about recent events and also kind of evaluate how they feel about them. So it's tough to say at this point.
Let me read a little bit of the latest data that I have, and then I want to talk to you about the idea of undecideds. Because, Joseph, every time we talk about battleground states, I get emails from listeners who say something along the lines of, how can there be any undecideds anymore? That can't be real. People know who Donald Trump is. They either love him or hate him or like him or won't vote for him. At the time when Joe Biden was the candidate, they would say, well, they know Joe Biden very well. What in the world is making someone undecided? But they do exist, and I want to talk to you a little bit about that. I'm looking at Wisconsin data. Among registered voters, Marquette's latest poll shows Kamala Harris trailing Donald Trump 50-49 among registered voters. But when they ask likely voters, Kamala Harris leads Donald Trump 50-49. It's essentially a tie. It's Marquette's first survey since June. That's Wisconsin. In Pennsylvania, Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are tied at 48% among likely Pennsylvania voters. That is per the Fabrizio Lee and Associates poll, which was paid for by Scott Pressler's Early Vote Action Political Action Committee, which is not something I'd ever heard of, but I have read that it is a Republican operation. So it's a Republican-sponsored poll, and it found a tie in Pennsylvania, Harris and Trump, 48-48. And in Michigan, Public Opinion Strategies poll completed last week, Trump 45, Harris 45. Now, I understand RFK, he just got on the ballot in one of the battleground states, and I'm not remembering. He's going to be on some ballots, I suppose. I suppose Jill Stein could get around 1% like she has in the past for the Green Party. Those things are possible. But you're looking at some of those numbers, Joseph, and people are saying, well, boy, that's close. But, who's undecided? Who's 45-45 in Michigan, 8% undecided? Who's undecided? That can't be real. What can you tell us about the idea of undecided voters?
I'm so delighted to tell you about them. So first, I want to just quickly mention the difference between these registered voters and likely voters.
Yes, I think that great place to start. Also. Yes, yes.
So it really varies by poll. So there's not one specific way of saying someone is a likely voter. That's not like a legal term, right? So some polls will literally ask you to like rank yourself, like how likely are you to vote? And that can be it. That can determine if they include you in the likely voter screen. So some people will take an entire poll, but not actually be that likely to vote, and they'll be willing to tell you that. Other polls will actually identify you. They'll pull your name off the voter rolls. So they'll actually have your voting history. And based on your previous voting history, so they know that you voted in, let's say, the previous 5 presidential elections, they'll say, hey, this person is a pretty likely voter. So those are some of the ways, and it really, again, can vary pretty significantly, that those numbers can differ between registered and likely voters. Now, undecided voters, these mythical creatures that the listeners of this program may have trouble imagining. I always want to tell people, if you can't imagine that, I think people who can't imagine undecided or sometimes maybe just uninterested is another way of thinking about many, but not all of them, is that you may be in kind of a partisan or political bubble where the people around you have very strong political opinions. But I believe it's the Times that has done a series where they talk with undecided voters recently. And one of them who always makes me laugh is a trans man. I think he works at like Target or Starbucks. And every time they check in with him, he just seems really, really bored. Like he's just super not interested in the entire presidential election. And while I can't relate to that, I think it's worth thinking about the mindset of people who are not super keyed into the presidential election. And maybe don't have a high understanding. So even, for example, if you canvass and you talk to real voters, they don't necessarily even have a strong understanding of which parties will represent, how they feel about specific issues. So there are voters who are maybe not super plugged into the process, maybe not super interested. And there are voters who I would say are cross-pressured. And that is they have some values or policies or identity that connects them maybe with one party and another that connects them strongly with a different party. So, for example, my grandmother, who was very strongly pro-life, but also cared a lot about environmental protections. And these are real people, right? And their votes are potentially up for grabs.
Yeah, I want to talk to you a little bit about what you also just described with the way people might not be as plugged in. So people listening to this program right now are probably pretty well plugged in to the presidential race, American politics. You know, maybe they were deep in the weeds on possible VP contenders and they feel like, you know, it's just a mystery that Americans would be sitting here going, well, I don't know if I'm going to vote in November, or I might vote, or I might vote, but I'm not sure who I'm going to vote for yet. But I'll give you an example of something that popped to me recently, and I'm trying to find out who this was. There was, because I'm not like big with the influencer crowd, Joseph. I'm like, I'm too old for that. But there are...
Me too, yeah.
Yes. There was the story of an influencer who was on a podcast, and he said he thought he was going to vote for Trump because he blamed President Biden for the abortion ban. And the podcast was like, you're blaming Joe Biden? You're like, you think Biden? And he's like, well, he's the president. He had the power to stop the ban, right? And, you know, like, so he was dunked on pretty widely for that. And I'll figure out who that is in a second. But this is somebody who's very popular and a lot of people listen to and had a very, very fleeting bit of information that there was the Dobbs decision happened. Obviously, he didn't like it. But in his mind, it was like, well, who's the president? Joe Biden? Okay, well, that's bad. I'm against Biden then. And we can mock that, but that's people aren't addicted to politics. People make decisions with sometimes incomplete information, and it's probably at our peril to mock it. What do you think, Joseph?
I think it's really important to take these people very seriously and the places they're coming from and the amount of information they have. And it's funny, I actually did meet a voter who had essentially the exact same opinion and had asked me essentially, my father is involved in Democratic Party politics in New Hampshire, and I was with him and he was talking to a random voter at a grocery store and had the exact same opinion pretty much, and had to have a conversation with my father to learn a bit more about the politics of abortion and political parties. I think these voters are more likely, but not necessarily, to be a bit younger. But there are a good proportion of people who are either undecided or often don't vote. There are a lot of people in this country who don't vote. I didn't prep any notes on that specifically, but a substantial amount of registered voters don't vote every year. And many people who could register to vote, are citizens and are able to vote, do not register to vote. So there's always a fairly substantial, you know, maybe something like 30% of the population, although I'm pulling that off the top of my head, of people who are just not that interested and figure the country will kind of continue onwards. And those are real people. They matter. They have lives. They have family. They're not aliens. They have material interests. They have often political views, although they might not call them that. So I think those people exist. As the kind of presidential election and polling continues, we may see less of them. Not that they disappear and go somewhere for the next few months, although that sounds kind of nice. But what happens is that we'll see more and more likely voter screens applied to polling instead of just looking at registered voters. And so those voters will kind of almost be filtered out a bit of the national conversation because, not voters, these unlikely or never voters will start to disappear from the conversation because of that.
So generally speaking, and this is what Chad just emailed me about, the difference between registered and likely, he wanted to just make sure we put a fine point on which one set of polling is better. Registered voters is one data set, likely voters is another. And as Joseph described for you, you know, how you determine who's a likely voter isn't going to be the exact same polling agency to polling agency. But in general, should we put more stock in the likely voters than the registered voters, Joseph?
Well, it depends on what you want to know. And you'll sometimes see polling that is of not of registered or of likely voters, but of just called all adults, right? So it'll even include people, and they'll often ask is the first question, are you registered to vote? Mm-hmm. But they may still include them in the poll because polling can kind of fulfill different functions. So the closer we get to the election, you do want these likely voter screens in the hope that it makes things more accurate. But I think it is still helpful to have these understanding of these other populations, right? So what does the average American adult think may not be the same as what a likely voter thinks, but those all matter, right? Those people still matter, even if they're maybe less likely to vote and put their vote into practice. Because of the Electoral College, many of our votes don't necessarily matter that much anyways, right? So I think it's helpful to think of them not as better, but of measuring different groups.
All right, fair enough, Chad. I hope that helps there. And, you know, on the subject of what does matter, I mean, I mentioned the influencer who was upset about abortion. Yesterday at a news conference, Donald Trump himself said that, well, he said a lot of interesting things. We're going to listen a little bit later to something else he said. But I want to talk a little about abortion. First of all, he was asked about whether he would support a national ban on mifepristone, which I think I'm pronouncing it correctly. It's the pill that's known as the abortion pill. And he sounded like someone who's never heard of it, but he said basically, yeah, we could look into that. We might make that happen. He was kind of like BSing an answer where he didn't study for the test. But I would assume he knows what that is. Anyway, his answer was he's open to a ban on that pill, a national ban on that pill, which would fall in towards that category of a national abortion ban. But he also said that he thinks we're at the point now where abortion is not going to be a big issue. He thinks it will be a comparatively small issue, have very little effect. Is there reason to believe that's true?
First of all, and I hate to keep riffing while we're doing this episode, but I'm addicted to the way he says we're looking into it very strongly,
yes,
often about things that he's probably, in my opinion, never heard of before. So I did not watch that particular press conference, so I don't know for sure. He has been kind of trying to triangulate on abortion, though, specifically, and I think the politics of that are a little interesting. So it may have been the same news conference, but he also said recently that he would reveal how he's going to vote on a Florida referendum about abortion. And he said his answer may surprise some people, which hard to know what that means exactly. But I think the point is that he's he knows a national abortion ban is very unpopular. In some ways, he's kind of stuck with the general sort of Republican view on abortion, but I think he's certainly willing to consider or say alternate perspectives, at least during the election period. I want to talk about kind of issues and how people rank them in determining their vote. So pretty consistently now, immigration and the economy have been sort of the top issues that voters have listed. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that other issues aren't important, both to us and to these voters, but those are pretty consistently the top two. Abortion, democracy, often also pretty high up there. But voters don't necessarily also make decisions just like looking at a policy sheet, right? They're making a decision about which candidates they best empathize with, and they may not have a firm grasp on policy either, and what sort of candidate might even do their preferred policies. So if you're a voter, good luck. I guess I always want to end with that. But I think voters are juggling a number of issues, and in some ways they may be even cross-pressured, as I said. There are certainly some voters who care about abortion, but may disagree with kind of a democratic economic program. Kind of interesting to me, and thinking kind of about issues and polling, is that Donald Trump's polling in terms of job approval has actually been very, very good for quite a while now. And I think this is a bit of an undercovered story with the attention on Biden recently. So his polling on issues on the economy and immigration is very good, as well as people kind of retroactively rating his job approval during his first presidential term. It's actually quite good. It's probably the best it's ever been. So in some ways, I think people were viewing this election as a story of Biden weakness. And of course, A, that is not as relevant anymore. But it's also a story, I think, of kind of some unexpected strength, where people are sort of reevaluating the Trump first presidential term and the economic atmosphere during that term and looking at it now when considering their vote.
Well, so let's talk a little about favorability ratings because I try to stay away from Twitter because I think it is bad for me and for anybody who is around it. But, you know, I have my weaknesses, Joseph. And recently, someone with an unnamed account was yelling at me because I had pointed out that Vice President Harris was not a very popular political figure as recently as June and, you know, still has underwater favorability ratings and, you know, has some headwinds that will make it difficult. That's one of the reasons that I think Democrats were a little hesitant to try to go forward with this plan to convince Joe Biden to leave the ticket, because Vice President Harris ran a campaign in 2019 where she didn't make it to Iowa. She was leading in the fall in some polls and then kind of fell apart. And there's all kinds of postmortems on her campaign then that indicate there were messaging problems and she was struggling to kind of coalesce on issues. And so now her approval ratings have been underwater. So I'm just looking at over time, her favorability ratings have been as low as 56% disapprove, 38% approve, as recently as just a little bit earlier this year. And, you know, so I don't know historically how difficult it is to overcome that kind of a number. Now that number has shrunk in half. So now she's 49% disapprove, 41% approve. So it's gone from a negative 16 or negative 18 to a negative 8 or 9. And that's a number that's moving in her direction ever since she became the nominee. So I want to ask a couple of questions. Number one, is there reason to believe that that trend in her direction will continue and, you know, eventually be a number that favors her? Number two, is it fair to say that before Joe Biden left this race, those numbers were kind of a warning sign that Vice President Harris might not be a strong candidate in a national election?
I will tackle the second part first.
Okay.
Yes, they were a warning sign that he might not be a strong candidate as a presidential candidate in the general election, as well as her relatively weak performance as a candidate in the 2020 primaries. But to connect to what we were talking about at the start of the hour in your introduction, when you talked about in polling, asking voters to consider what if a generic Democrat ran. Or what if specific candidate ran. I've also heard it referred to as generic Republican, generic Democrat, or Democratic Jesus, Republican Jesus. So the idea is some mythical candidate you can say, oh, all the good things I like and none of the bad things I don't like. But what we've, I think is really important is that people are not good in polling at answering conditional questions. And that is the sort of question where if X happened, how would that affect your vote? So I think it's good to steer away from those types of questions, as valuable as they can sound. And I think this is a perfect example of it. People didn't necessarily say, you know, if this happens and they switch in Kamala Harris, you know, they'll earn my vote. But then it happened and a lot of people did end up switching their vote, right? And there is a positive trend for her now. So even though there's arguably this piece of evidence that this wouldn't happen, what we've seen is that people are not good at estimating their own behavior in response to a change in the environment. And I think that's helpful to know. And I don't remember your first question, I'm sorry.
Is it likely that the trend, which has gone from, you know, her numbers deeply underwater in the teens, the mid-teens, to a single digit underwater with favorability since she became the nominee, is it reasonable to assume that that will continue to move in her favor?
I don't think it's reasonable to make an assumption either way. I think, A, what we talked about before, where there's a number of major events that are still settling in. I'm sure there's some voter, by the way, who hasn't even heard of the assassination attempt on Trump. I think right. That's just helpful context. Like, I'm sure that person exists somewhere, and they're living a better life than we do also. But yeah, I think it's difficult to conceive of this way. Well, we can't know that trends will continue. Necessarily. So even if there's a positive trend currently, it's difficult to say, and she'll continue gaining. I don't feel confident with that. I do think there's potentially some upside in the future. Usually at the Democratic and Republican conventions, there's a brief polling bump for the respective parties. immediately after, because they kind of get a few nights to themselves to show off their preferred policy programs and show themselves at the best. So there's often some highlights there. But it's difficult to say, you know, this is definitely going to happen. I think that's kind of beyond the realm of polling and into being a psychic, which would be great, but we're not offering that yet.
Okay, and Joseph is very good at tempering any sort of really fully pat explanation for anything, because things are complicated. The way people vote is complicated. It's easy to say, well, this election went this way because of one thing, and that thing is X. And Joseph is very good at telling us that's maybe part of the story, maybe a big part of the story, but it's complex. So, as a student of yours, if I wrote the following paragraph, would you say, okay, you're going to get a passing grade, I'm not positive that's it. If I wrote the following, what we have learned so far since the switch at the top of the Democratic ticket is that voters truly were desperate to move past an election where they felt like the country is a gerontocracy, where people will not cede power under any circumstances, where leadership is getting older and older and more disconnected. They were so desperate for younger leadership that they were willing to cheer anyone who comes into that position. And that puts Vice President Harris in a very good position, but now she must strengthen that support, cement that support, and earn more support with her own performance on the trail, whether it's policy positions, responding to voters, et cetera. Her performance will now determine how she does from here to November. What do you think?
I think that's a large part of the story. And the other part of it is not just the general, but the specific, and that she's had and I hate to play pundit, but I think a very well-executed kind of transition and campaign rollout. So I think that's been a large part of the success story as well. The kind of chaos or drama of potentially switching out Biden for Kamala or someone has been avoided in a way that I think really helped her kind of unite the Democratic Party, put on a positive image that people can join. But definitely, I think part of it is moving away from a repeat of the last election we just had, and from Biden, who had very low approval numbers. So I would give you a passing grade for sure. For okay. You, Evan, yes.
Thank you very much, Professor Burgess. Joseph Burgess is team leader at the Social Sciences Data Lab at the University of Copenhagen. He's got Rochester and Western New York roots, experience here, and now joining us to talk about how we take in data. On the other side of this break, which we'll take now, I want to hit a couple of other issues with him. First off, I got a little bit of sound from yesterday's never-ending news conference with Donald Trump, which, listen, I've had listeners say at least he's doing news conferences, and I think candidates should do them. As a journalist, I'm always in favor of people answering more questions, not fewer. But some of his answers were quite bizarre, and we're going to talk a little bit about that, and I've got a clip to share with you. And I want to talk to Joseph about this idea that Americans are concerned about mental cognition and, you know, Biden vis-a-vis Trump. And so we'll talk a little bit about that. There are some other issues that I know Joseph wants to get to. And we've got some more of your questions, listeners, that have come in. We've got a pile of emails that we're going to sort through. You can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. This is our only break, and we're right back. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, a new project aims to improve behavioral health services for people of color in Rochester especially. We talk about coordinated care services efforts to train family peer advocates here and the impact it could have. In our second hour, one of the most progressive churches in Rochester has a new leader. We welcome the new senior minister at Asbury First United Methodist Church. Talk with you Monday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Connections team member Gary Puttup sends a note with a New York Times story indicating that 17% of voters blame President Biden for the abortion ban or for Dobbs. That's 1 in 6 voters. So I mentioned earlier this influencer who went viral when he was saying he's probably going to vote for Trump. He didn't like the, in his words, the abortion ban, and Biden is president, so he blames Biden. That's not necessarily an outlier. That's a number of millions of our fellow American citizens who feel that way. So, Gary's also wondering, Joseph Burgess, when we look at polling, when we look at numbers, and you look at sort of groups of voters, there is this movement called uncommitted. And we saw them primarily in Michigan, but in some other states as well. As an example, their presence in the Democratic primary in Michigan this year resulted in something like 100,000 votes for uncommitted in the Democratic primary. They are deeply concerned about Gaza, the plight of the Palestinian people, Israeli actions in Gaza, and they want to see change at the administration's level. And so there's this idea that if they are not moved by the top of the ticket, that they may sit it out or they might vote for Donald Trump, and that Vice President Harris could lose. We saw at a Michigan rally this week, Vice President Harris was interrupted by a group of protesters who were challenging her on the issues in Gaza. I don't know exactly what they were chanting, but they interrupted her once, and she said, you know, I met with a group beforehand. We're going to talk more. And then they interrupted her again, and she shut them down. She said, you know, if you want Donald Trump to win, just say so. Otherwise, I'm talking now. And the crowd went crazy. But it was viewed by the uncommitted movement as rude and maybe tone deaf. And there's this idea that, well, if she loses them, she could lose the election. So how do we know what kind of impact? I mean, we don't know for sure, but how do we kind of evaluate the possible impact of movements like that, Joseph?
Sure. So just one very quick thing. I just wanted to say, Evan jokingly called me professor earlier, and I just wanted to make sure not to misrepresent my credentials.
Oh, you are not a professor. I was calling you professor as if I am your student. Yes, that was cheeky. That was cheeky.
Exactly. There just to be clear to our listeners. But back to the topic at hand. So I think there's a few different ways of thinking about this. I think people who care deeply about the conflict in Palestinian territories could definitely swing the election. I think a large part of that is everything is so tight that anything could swing the election. You could have like the association of dog lovers, if they got really mad and had one candidate or the other, could swing the election at this point. So when we're talking about a very small difference in votes that could separate the candidates in the swing states, almost any potential issue, including this one and including this movement of uncommitted, the uncommitted movement or whatever we're calling it, could definitely potentially have an overall huge impact because of the tightness of the overall election. Ways of kind of thinking about them, it's very difficult to say right now. And I think part of it is that Harris has not really fully sketched out any sort of policy platform of her own on the conflict. So interestingly, in the before the rally when she was protested, she did indicate a potential openness to some change in policy, including, I think, an arms embargo against Israel. So it's difficult to say because Harris has not fully decided on her own relationship with the movement and with policy at this point. And I think we're in this evolving and rapidly evolving situation where if she changes policy, I think those voters will react accordingly. It's hard to know. So not many people necessarily list this as their top issue. We mentioned a few of the top issues already. But again, when everything is so close and we're in the, you know, the third election in a row, when the swing states are all looking very, very close, could be a few tens of thousands of votes separating the candidates there, anything could be end up being the reason, right?
Absolutely. You know, the point that Joseph just made is an important one to underscore, and some listeners have been critical of me for pointing this out, but it is just a fact that Vice President Harris, as of yesterday at least, didn't even have a policies page on her website. So if you want to know where she is on the issues, you're not going to find it on her website. It's not out yet. Her team has said they're working on it. Well, it is August. There are 3 months, and, you know, that's a long time in international elections. But she should answer those questions. She should talk to reporters at length about how she views Gaza, how she views any number of issues. And her team has said she will do that and do that soon. And I think people should look forward to that, because if you are undecided, you should probably know where she stands on the issues, and it should probably not be difficult to find out. Now, Peter writes to the program and says, on undecided voters, he says, is it not likely that those who declare that they are undecided are likely to be generally decided, but would not choose to disclose their choice? Joseph?
I think that's certainly some percentage of the undecided population. So when you're talking about very small groups of people, they're hard to measure. So you're thinking of not just the people who say they're undecided, but they're undecided for that specific reason. So that's very, very hard to accurately measure. And part of it is because they don't really want to talk to you, right? So by definition, they're pretty hard to understand or further study. So I would say that some of the people, but I would say from what we can guess, a much larger percentage of those undecideds are people who are probably not going to vote. And I think those are usually understood as the, and again, there are less and less of them as the campaign continues, but I would understand them as kind of the largest population of undecideds. Another thing I wanted to add to that, and on your point about policy, we really should understand the election not as 3 months from now, but now to 3 months to now. So really, overseas and military voting will begin very, very shortly. I'm actually getting an email about making sure to apply for my ballot now. So people will begin voting in overseas and territories very soon. Other absentee and early votes will begin, I think, probably in late September. So we're really pretty close to the election beginning in earnest. It's not like it's 3 months away at this point. It's more like we're just days or weeks away from the first voters voting. If they haven't already, maybe there's some small cases of military voters who have done that.
A very good and important distinction. So I appreciate that. And Joseph, I also wanted to ask you a little bit about, as we try to understand data better, there's been some discussion of the Washington all-party primary as some kind of way of understanding polling, or at least kind of like a little bit of a dipstick on where people are. So, I don't know a whole lot about it myself. I just want to kind of ask you if there's something to be gleaned from that.
Absolutely. So just to return to an earlier episode of Connections, when we talked in 2022, I can't believe that was 2 years ago,
yeah, almost,
but here we are. I said I thought there was a real chance that it wouldn't be a red wave environment. And one of the things I pointed to was this Washington all-party primary, which I'll explain in a second, as a reason for why I thought that. So I said there's this piece of data, at least, that points in a different direction, and it's worth considering, and people are taking it more seriously and thinking about it. So to put it in context, the polling is improving for Kamala Harris. She looks very competitive to win in these number of swing states, as well as doing better in national polls. So one thing people have been looking at is, again, this Washington all-party primary. And so what that means is that all candidates from all parties run on the same ballot, and you can pick one of them, and the top two move forward. California has a somewhat similar system. And the idea is essentially to, instead of doing these purely partisan primaries where one Democrat and one Republican moves forward, it's the top two contenders no matter what. And in some like very red districts, you could even see two Republicans move forward to the general ballot and vice versa. And people have looked at this as maybe having some predictive value. So it just happened this Tuesday in Washington. And while the final results are not in yet, people are looking at what it looked like in relation to 2020, for example. And it looks like it's maybe a couple points to the left, i.e. Democrats generally did better than they did in 2020. So it's not the only signal we should consider, but it is really interesting to think about, especially when looking at kind of these polls showing that Kamala is doing a little better now, especially compared to Biden, that we're getting this positive sign for Democrats in this specific state. So it's not everything. And of course, Washington is a very white state. So it's not necessarily representative of the whole country, right? But it's one definitely very positive point the Democrats could feel good about.
All right. Joseph Burgess, my guest. He's not a professor. He's the team leader at the Social Sciences Data Lab at the University of Copenhagen. If you hear me call him professor, it's just because I think he's smart. It's just a little honorific he gets for being on this program. I want to listen to a little bit of sound from yesterday's news conference that Donald Trump held. And, he spoke at length on any number of issues, but one of the reasons that President Biden is out of this race is because it became clear to the general public that it wasn't just a stutter or a speech impediment that President Biden has talked about for years that, you know, first started in his childhood. It was, you know, some cognitive decline. And there's been a lot of reporting on it. It is, if you are just looking at it in human terms, can be sad. It's tough. You know, no one wants to slow down a little bit, but, you know, he's got the hardest job in the world and he's in his 80s. So I think we can have some grace for that. But at the same time, his party, when they saw it, not only in June, but in other circumstances, his party did not want to see him top the ticket. Now that he is out, what you have is Donald Trump, who is going to be, if he wins this election, he'll be 82 in control of a nuclear arsenal 4 years from now. And the question is, are there indications that he is not fully, you know, mentally at the top capacity? Is he misremembering? Is he struggling with details? Is he flubbing things? Is there something that's disconnected? And yesterday he was asked a question. You're going to hear it. It's not the best audio, but the question, it's kind of a leading question, actually. It was kind of a strange question about Kamala Harris's rise through politics. Now, one of the allegations that the right is making is that Vice President Harris got to where she is because she dated people in power. She got promoted because of those relationships, et cetera. Well, one of her ex-boyfriends is former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown, not Jerry Brown, the former governor of California. So Trump gets asked about Willie Brown, and he ends up telling a story that is both not true and it confuses which Brown. In 2018, when he was president, he was part of a delegation that flew on a helicopter to survey the Park Fire damage in California that burned thousands and thousands of acres and needed federal help. And he flew on that plane with Gavin Newsom, the governor of California, and who's governor now of California, and Jerry Brown, who had been governor of California. Not Willie Brown, the mayor of San Francisco, who dated Kamala Harris. He flew with Jerry Brown. The helicopter landed safely. There was no incident. There's no reporting of any incident. Everyone involved has talked about there being no incident. And yet Donald Trump is about to tell a story in which he's on a plane, on a helicopter with Willie Brown, not Jerry Brown. He misremembers which Brown, and claims that it almost crashed and they almost died, which is a bizarre story to tell that didn't happen. Let's listen.
Harris's relationship with Willie Brown, yep, former mayor of San Francisco, and how that might have intersected with her career trajectory. So I'm just wondering if you followed that discussion at all and have any thoughts on that.
Well, I know Willie Brown very well. In fact, I went down in a helicopter with him. We thought maybe this is the end. We were in a helicopter going to a certain location together, and there was an emergency landing. This was not a pleasant landing, and Willie was, he was a little concerned. So I know him pretty well. I haven't seen him in years. But he told me terrible things about her. But this is what you're telling me anyway, I guess. But he had a big part in what happened with Kamala. But he I don't know, maybe he's changed his tune, but he was not a fan of hers very much at that point.
President, do you believe Vice President Harris would certify your election victory if you win?
Yeah, I do.
Okay, so that's Donald Trump yesterday. He is not talking about the correct person. He's literally misremembering. And if you just want to, you know, if you just want to be blunt about it, just in terms of factual details, the mayor of San Francisco for many years, Willie Brown, is a black man. Jerry Brown, the governor who he was flying with, is a white man. They're not the same person. Willie Brown is in his 90s now and was asked about this yesterday, and he just laughed and he said, "Donald Trump, I didn't fly in a helicopter with Donald Trump. He's not thinking of the right guy, and he's using his fictional imagination." Gavin Newsom and others have said that plane, that helicopter, never came close to crashing. There was never a concern about a crash. So he's either lying or misremembering. He's also misremembering which person. And if Joe Biden did that, do you think that there would be any hesitation among the right-wing media to attack it? At what point does it become an issue? So, Joseph Burgess, does this become a thing where people have to, I don't know that it is. In the electorate that will vote for Donald Trump, there's probably a floor, and it's probably very firm, and it probably isn't going to go below a certain number no matter what happens. But clips like that, do they even matter?
It's funny. I had actually not even heard the clip or read about this incident until now, which just shows how much is going on in terms of things that might have been a big deal 10 years ago, but now I don't even see it on my Twitter feed. So, you know, you want to think about how and why something becomes an issue, right? So, you know, of course, the reason Biden's age had consequences for him is that, and I don't necessarily mean this as a criticism, both the media and his partisan opposition decided to make it an issue and repeatedly attacked him on his age, or criticized or investigated. With Trump, I think that could be a little difficult. We're not sure if Harris wants to run that sort of campaign that will be negative against him on that. It's not clear if the media wants to investigate it in those terms. And then also, Trump has also said a lot of very strange things throughout the years. I don't even mean that as a particularly political comment. But while this is a kind of strange story for him, it's not even necessarily clear to me that it's his age, as opposed to just another thing that he said. So it's not clear to me whether this will be an issue, although he's very close to the same age as Biden. Even in polling, his age has not necessarily been a kind of focus or a concern for voters as much or anywhere near as much as it has been for Biden. Age and kind of capacity, mental capacity.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And that clip is, that's not going to sink his election chances. I mean, Those kind of either misrememberings or exaggerations don't seem to matter to people. And on top of that, by the way, he flew out there as president after a devastating, massive, historic fire. And the story he chooses to tell is all about himself. I was in a helicopter and almost went down, and boy, that was scary. When it didn't even happen. You know, it sounds like disordered thinking at the baseline here, but I don't know that it matters. Anyway,
Evan, you're thinking like it's 12 years ago. Like this is something I don't mean in a mean way, but voters are so past the idea of maybe this mattering. I think unless it becomes an issue, and that's part of the process, and when media, including you know even shows like this, talk about it, then we could see it. And also if it progresses, if he says things that are maybe stranger or more offensive to people, then it could continue to become an issue. But it's difficult to, again, predict the future. So we'll see.
Okay. One more question from a listener. James wants to know just about the economy. He said your guest said that immigration and the economy will continue to be some of the top issues, but people can't even agree on if the economy is doing well or if it is cratering. That's a fair point that James raises there. And maybe part of what he is saying is you can look at data, and the data indicates that number one, the United States handled inflation better than most countries around the world. Number two, unemployment has been at historic lows. The Dow, after a very turbulent week, has still been around record territory. After Donald Trump said it would crash, it soared. Gas prices never came close to $8-$9 a gallon that Trump said they would. So, I mean, like you could put it that way, but then there's still income inequality. There's still people really struggling to pay for housing. And there's all kinds of indicators that things are not great. So how do we look at the economy, Joseph?
Sure. So I think there's two answers. One, you look at a number of metrics, but I'm a polling guy, right? So I'm not necessarily interested in what is real or measured in economic terms. What I'm interested in people's perceptions of the economy. And I would say people actually largely do agree about the economy. And by people, I mean the general population, not economists. And they think the economy is bad. They're pretty clear about it. So in a wide range of polling about the American economy, they think it's not going very well. So we haven't had a ton of polling specifically about this post they kind of switched to Harris, which can, you know, impact how people see the economy. But generally, the polling about the economy is very negative. People are view the economy really poorly right now.
Okay. So that's probably not going to help the I was going to say the incumbent vice president who's running for president. She is part of the administration, after all. All right, last minute, Joseph, how do we spend the next 3 months being smart data consumers? I always ask you this question, but it's always a good one. How do we become smarter data consumers?
That's a great question, and I don't think you have asked it before.
Although maybe the first. Yeah, there you go.
Well, now's a good time to do it as ever. I would say log off. The best thing you can do for yourself. So I think there's, unless you are me or you are maybe Evan, I don't think you necessarily need to breathlessly follow every poll or look at an index of polls every day. I think it's good to, if you want to get involved in politics, I think you should do that in a real way by participating, by volunteering, by talking to your friends and family but I think being online and just reading and consuming politics instead of participating is not very healthy. So I would say the best thing you can do for yourself is actually anchor yourself to the real things in life, as opposed to kind of consuming politics and political data.
I think that's very good advice. In the meantime, there is a lot happening around the world, and I hope we can talk again sometime soon to kind of take stock of some of what we've seen in different elections, because interestingly enough, Joseph, it's not easy for me to get a handle on, is sort of authoritarianism on the rise, or has there been a pushback? How much do we take what happened in France and other places? That's for another day, perhaps. Let's let's talk again soon if we could.
Evan, thanks so much for having me on.
Great to have you. Joseph Burgess, team leader at the Social Sciences Data Lab at the University of Copenhagen. Listeners, hope you've enjoyed the program this week. Thank you for listening, and hope you have a wonderful weekend in store. From Gary and Evan and Rob and Megan and the whole team, we're saying thanks for listening. We are back with you next week on Member Supported Public Radio.